OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 11. Hey everyone, Tim Robertson here on OWC Radio 2.0, and like I said, this is our 11th episode. I said last week that we're going to a weekly format, and this is really the first episode of the weekly format. I mean, I said last week was, but that came out 2 weeks after the last episode, so really, this is the first episode of the weekly format. Happy to be with you guys. I'm really encouraged by the email that I've been getting from you, and I really do ask that you continue to send in the feedback. It helps me make the show better. And I want to make clear, even though I've been podcasting for 10 years, I am by no means an expert when it comes to content. By that, I mean I'm always open to suggestions. If I'm hitting on a topic that you guys think is just, you know, overplayed on podcasts and you don't really want to hear about it, let me know. We can change things up. You want to hear more tips and tricks, so we can go that route as well. If you have questions about your Mac or your iPhone or your iPad that you're just not getting the answers anywhere else, send those in and I can research it for you. We've got some very, very talented people at Otherworld Computing that if I don't know the answer, I'm sure one of them will. And if none of us know, I'll come back and say that on the podcast that we don't know. We've looked into it. We cannot figure it out. That's pretty rare though. There's some very, very smart people, much smarter than me. And, I can't guarantee it, but I can almost guarantee that we'll find an answer for you. How's that? How's that for a non-guarantee? This is going to be a fun episode. I did an interview. It's been a couple weeks now since we recorded it. And I'm happy to be playing it here on this episode. Paul Lefevre is our interviewee. He's a OWC customer. And Paul is a software evangelist. More than that, though, he's a software evangelist for a set of developer tools, a development platform that works with the Mac, obviously. And it's called Zojo. It's really, really cool software. I'm not a developer by any means, and I make that quite clear during the interview. One of the programs that I've used in the past extensively was built using Zojo as a platform, and that was Lightspeed. It's a point-of-sale software, ran on the Mac, lets you do inventory, checking out, like, you know, someone bringing it up to the counter, and you use a scanner to, you know, scan the barcode, and it, you know how that works. Setting appointments. It was a great piece of software. Well, it wasn't great. It had problems, but it tried to do a lot of things, and it did most things decently and a few things really good. But when you try to be kind of an all-encompassing software solution, some things are going to kind of fall to the wayside. There really isn't great solutions on the Mac when it comes to point of sale. There are some for the iOS platform now. I've seen more than a few businesses using iPhones, iPod Touches, and iPads as, you know, that's what people use to check you out. Apple obviously does that, but for the most part on the Mac, it's slim pickings, unfortunately. I think that will probably change as more and more time goes on because, once again, Apple just recently came out with their financials, if you will, and the Mac is still growing. The rest of the PC market has been in decline now for what, almost 2 years? Something like that. And the Mac is continuously growing. More people are buying Macs than ever before. And I find that obviously very encouraging because it's a platform that I've been using myself for 20 years and I love it. And I'm glad when people kind of move away from, I don't want to say inferior, but in my mind, not as good system software, computers that aren't as well built, and kind of see the light, I guess. But that's just my opinion. And it's I'm not saying that PCs aren't as good as Macs. There's a lot of you that use PCs. Heck, I use PCs when I need to. But for my money and the time I'm going to sit in front of a computer, I want a Mac. And I'm sure a lot of you are probably in the same boat. I saw some cool news that came out this week. One of my old favorite games for the iPad was a game called Sentinel. Now, it was a tower defense game. That's when the enemies come from one part of the screen and you got to build little towers to shoot them before they get to your home base. The one I really liked was called Sentinel. 1, 2, and 3. They were all really good games. I don't believe any of them were free. I paid a couple bucks for each one. But those were the tower defense games that I enjoyed more than the others that were out there. I just really, really liked them. And Sentinel 3 was kind of the last one, and that came out 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, it's been a long time. And I was browsing the iTunes store, and I came across Sentinel 4 Darkstar that just came out. And, you know, it was like $5. I bought it right away because I had a really good experience with the first three games. And I really like this game. So if you are a tower defense game player, and of course you need an iPad or an iPhone. I can't play on my iPhone. It's just too small. And I enjoy playing it on my iPad, let me put it that way, more than I would on my iPhone. It's a fun game. I really like it. And I'm stuck on the fourth level. Four levels. I'm a good video game player. And man, the difficulty ratchets up really, really quick. I'm playing first three levels, think I'm kicking butt, and I hit that fourth level, and I get to the very end, and they get me every time. I've played it like 7 times now, and I don't know. I've got to go back and figure out a new strategy or something because I'm losing, and I don't like that. Speaking of video games, though, for your iOS device, there's one other one that I thought was really kind of cool, and I don't know how many people saw this. Now, you know the restaurant Denny's. I mean, we've all eaten there, right? It's not the greatest food in the world. It's not the worst food in the world. It's Denny's, you know? And I really always kind of enjoyed their the breakfast things in the morning. You can get them for dirt cheap. And it was always pretty filling, and it tasted good. So, Denny's it is. Especially when I was in my, you know, early 20s, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had to do something. I'll let your imaginations take it from there. Denny's would be one of our stops, me and my group of friends. Let's head to Denny's. And what does Denny's have to do with iOS, iPhones, iPads? Well, they came out with a game, believe it or not. And I think this is a brilliant move. I would love to see more companies do something like this. What Denny's, the restaurant chain, did was work with Atari, and they took classic Atari video games and they remixed them. Now, the name of the app is Denny's Atari Remix, and it's a free app, and it remixes three classic games. You remember Asteroids? Well, it plays exactly the same, except this is called Hashtroids. You got to be careful when you say that, by the way. And it's like hash browns. There's a centipup rather than centipede. I don't know what the centipup refers to be honest. I haven't been to Denny's in a while. And there's a takeout, which is instead of breakout, you know, the game where the little ball falls down and you got to bounce it back up to. Yeah, it's called takeout. And it's free. And I tried it. I downloaded it. And they're really fun. I mean, they do feel like the original games on the Atari arcades. And I think this is brilliant. Don't you think this is a really good marketing move for Denny's? I think it is. I mean, they're getting free advertising right now, ostensibly, right? I'm talking about Denny's. I've talked about their food. I've talked about their app. So they've got 5 minutes of free advertising here on OWC Radio because they came out with this app that I thought was a very clever idea. They didn't rip off Atari. They worked with Atari to make these remixes, and it's really well done. So I would encourage you, if you are fans of casual gaming on iOS, those are two games. One's about $5, Sentinel 4 Darkstar, or Denny's Atari Remix, which is free. And both of them, I guarantee you, you'll be playing for a good solid week. That's how much fun they are. And if you're even more of a casual gamer, you don't play quite that much, that's a month worth of entertainment right there for $5. I mean, what more could you ask for, right? I think it's a good deal, and Well, Denny's didn't get my money, but although I'll be honest, maybe they will. Maybe just having this app on my phone and seeing that little logo and it says Denny's right on it, maybe the next time I'm looking for a place to eat breakfast, that'll just pop into my head. Subliminal advertising. Not even really subliminal, is it? It works. So kudos to them for doing something innovative, different, and fun. An app that was just released in beta form. Beta is how they say it in the UK. Here in the US, we say beta. It's a program called Mailbox. Now, this was a mail client that originally started life on the iPad. Dropbox owns them. At one time, I knew a little bit more of the history, but I believe Mailbox actually came out on the iPad with their app, and then Dropbox purchased them. Or they had demos out, or they were advertising it, and then whatever. But Dropbox has owned Mailbox. It's got good reviews on the iPad. Well, they just released a beta version for the Mac, and I'm intrigued. Here's my big gripe with email and the Mac. I think by far the worst app Apple has created in years is Mail on the Mac. I know some of you are probably throwing up your hands and screaming blasphemy, but I don't like the Mail app on the Mac at all. I'm not sure. I've got a lot of problems with it, number one. It's just not intuitive for me. It's a little buggy. It doesn't always find messages when I do a search. I can do a spotlight search in the Finder, and I'll find messages that way. But if I actually search in the Mail app, can't find them. Not all of them, but it's a problem. For whatever reason, forgets what's junk mail. I get 20 emails in one day, and they all have a common word in it, like Rogaine or herpes or something like that. That's obviously junk mail, right? And I click junk, 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 junk on every single one of them. The very next day, two or three more sitting in my inbox, and then three of them in my junk folder. Hello? You picked up that three of them were junk. Why didn't you pick up the other two? It's aggravating. And it does take time for it to learn. But I've been using this Mail app for years now. And I'll be honest with you. It's not a good app, in my opinion. My favorite map, or my favorite Macintosh email program for a long time was, this kind of tells you how far back I go, was the built-in email client in Netscape Navigator. That's how far back I go. I loved that app. I don't know why. And I look at screenshots of it now and I go, ooh, I wouldn't want to use that. So Mail is better than that. I liked Eudora for a long time. I tried using that recently. It kind of shows its age. It feels like a Mac OS 7 app still. Even it's not, but it feels that way. I don't think, in my opinion, there is a great email client on the Mac. And I cannot figure out why. It's, other than a web browser, it's the one app that we all use, isn't it? I know some of you are probably using Gmail via a web browser. I can't. My demands on email is way more, is a lot bigger than just an email client in a web browser. I need more control. I need more flexibility. I need more power. And Mail just doesn't do it for me. One in a web browser definitely doesn't do it for me. And there hasn't been, at least that I know of, and I've searched, a killer mail program. And I was really kind of looking forward to what they were going to do with Mailbox from Dropbox. Is this going to be the one? It's a very beautiful app. It's just elegant. Some of the features that they brought over from the iPad version seems to be working really well on the Mac. Now, I didn't download this for a couple reasons, but the big one is it's so limiting. It only works with Gmail and iCloud accounts. No IMAP, no Exchange. I don't get it. You made a beautiful app and then you crippled it. It makes no sense to me. So it's that right there. It's a non-starter. right there makes it a complete non-starter for me. And it's disappointing because it looks like they were on the right track, and yet they only support iCloud and Gmail. I don't get it. I don't get it at all. Maybe when they come out of non-beta, when it, you know, it's an actual released product, maybe they'll support IMAP at that point, but it doesn't look good. And I can't figure out why nobody's making a great email client. I think there's a market for it. I think people will buy a superior email client over that which ships with the Mac. I really do. I know I would. I've got money in my pocket ready to give a developer who makes a great email client. It's email. I've been using email clients for 20 years. And this is the state of them? It's crazy to me. I don't get it. And I hope a company really comes along and does something about it, because I think it's a problem. What's not a problem, though, is the NFL Now app was released on the Apple TV. Do you have an Apple TV? I've got three of them. I've got the original, you know, quarter-sized pizza box one that had a hard drive built into it. The gray thing kind of looked like a skinnier original Mac Mini. And I've got an Apple TV 2 and 3. And they're great devices. I like them a lot. I don't use them as much as you would think I would owning two. But they're fantastic. And I have to be honest, I'm a huge NFL fan. I live in Michigan, so you can guess which team I root for. And I'm really looking forward to playing with this app more than the 10 minutes that I've had with it so far. To be honest, though, it seemed to take forever for content to start playing. I would select something, and it would just took forever. And I thought, well, maybe it's just my Apple TV, and I went over to the Netflix app, and boom, that just started immediately. I went over to the Disney HD app. That started immediately. So, I don't know, maybe it's growing pains for the NFL Network and this NFL Now app on the Apple TV. Maybe it'll get better really quickly here because the season is less than 2 weeks away. And it's pretty cool. Instant in-game highlights, live events, press conferences. But there's more that you can get with a subscription. Costs $2 a month. I don't know if I'm going to go that route yet. But it's only $2 a month. And they pull the money right out of your iTunes account, because it's on the Apple TV. So you don't have to give the NFL Network your credit card or anything like that. If you have your PayPal tied into your iTunes account, it pulls it right out of PayPal. I think this is... do you think this is kind of heralding a new age for the Apple TV? Do you think there's more apps on the way? I know I've talked about before games and productivity and communication software for the Apple TV and how great that would be. You know, I think there's got to be something coming from Apple when it comes to the Apple TV. They're not ignoring it like they did for a long time. They didn't. They're not regulating it as a hobby device anymore. So I want to see more. And I think that something like the NFL Now coming to the Apple TV, and it's available for the iPad and the iPhone as well, so you can get on those devices. I think this kind of heralds more of a commitment from Apple to push out really cool content to the Apple TV. And as more and more shows are moving to an online format, you know, the Apple TV could really be a big, important device for Apple moving forward. And like I said, I like the Apple TV. I just don't use it as much as I thought I would. But it's $100, right? $99. I've got two of them. I know I'll buy a new one if and when it comes out. I think I'll probably retire my second one. I don't know yet. But I really like the app. It's just slow. I don't know why. It seems to be hung up. Maybe it's because everyone just got this pushed out to them, and everybody, all the football fans, are immediately playing with it, and the network's like, whoa, hold on there, Nelly. I don't know, but it needs to be more peppy. So I'm going to give it a try again later tonight, and I know there's some preseason games coming up this weekend. I'll give it a try then. I don't know if you can actually watch a game using it or not. That's something I didn't look into, and I didn't see anything online that you could. But wouldn't that kind of defeat the purpose of having it? Look, you can get, like, the Disney HD channels. You have to sign in with whatever cable provider that you have in your area to be able to use and view the app. In other words, if you don't have cable television, let's say you just have internet, the Disney HD channel is not going to do anything because you have to be a subscriber to be able to view content. I assume that's going to be the same way with the NFL Now app. I don't know. I have to go back and look at it because I'm just unsure. But I didn't sign up or log into my cable account when I fired it up. And it has its own subscription. And if it has its own subscription, I would assume then will you stream games to me? I know it does older games, archive stuff. But, you know, I know how those games ended. Well, not all of them, but I want to watch the new games. You know, if I'm in a market, but my team that I root for is, you know, on the other side of the country and I want to watch that game, my local cable provider can't help me there. Will this app? I don't think so. And if it doesn't, that's kind of a disappointment. You know, it's kind of you can do these little fun things over here, but if you still want to watch the games, sorry, you can't do that. I don't know. I have to look into it more. I'm speaking out of ignorance, and I don't usually like to do that. Although, my wife will caution you that it's an everyday occurrence. Last thing I wanted to talk about, and that is some email from you guys. I know the iPhone event thing that everyone's talking about online, and 4.7, 5.5 iPhone, what's coming, Sapphire displays. I don't know. Nobody knows yet. Well, or at least the people who do know, they're not telling me. And, you know, half the fun, I think, is speculating. And I do that occasionally. You know, I talked about the rumored iWatch here, as well as what could be coming out for the Apple TV eventually. But that's speculation. That's not really commenting on rumors as much. We're so close to this event that everyone seems to know is happening like the first week and a half of September. I'm just content to wait, to be honest. I want to be wowed. I want to be excited for this, whatever it is. And I bet a lot of you are like that, too. You're probably sick of hearing about the iPhone 4 or iPhone 6 rumors. iPhone 4. I can tell you what the iPhone 4 is going to be. A year later, there'll be an iPhone 4S. So I'm not going to get into that. But we did have some feedback. I got some great feedback from John F., and he asks, are you going to comment on Microsoft's recent decision to have Skype not support macOS 10 prior to Mavericks, but still producing Skype software and still supporting XP? Linux support is just dropped. There are a lot of Macs still out there that cannot run Mavericks. He's right, John, you're right. But I'm not surprised a bit. Remember, it's Microsoft. They have... If anything, I have to suppose that Skype is probably a loss leader. They don't make money with Skype. And Lord knows they spent a lot of money to acquire Skype from eBay. But I don't think Microsoft makes a dime on Skype. It probably costs them a lot. They make money with OSs on the PC side. And I can understand why they're going to support their own platform and minimally support the Mac. And if they're going to support the Mac, they might as well support the more recent ones. It's probably a small team at Microsoft that is, well, look, I use Skype weekly, and I can tell you it needs a lot of help. It's buggy, it's crashy, and it's always been this way, even before Microsoft owned it, even before eBay owned it. It's never great software as far as the interface and the reliability. The only thing it really had going for it is the clarity of vocal communications. I think it's still the best when it comes to talking to someone over the internet. I don't think in any other service, at least the ones that I've tried, even comes close. Skype is the best. But I doubt if there's a big team at Microsoft working on Skype. And that's probably because it's a loss leader. They don't make money. So it doesn't surprise me. It is disappointing. Can you even, you know, if they're not supporting it, does that mean older versions will cease to operate and they just won't work anymore? That I don't know. If you could let me know that, John, by not supporting, does that mean if I'm on Tiger, for instance, and I've got the last version that runs on Tiger of Skype, do they pull the plug so I can't call anybody with a newer version? That would be, I would be a little ticked off about that. But them not supporting newer versions on older macOS, it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't even really upset me. It's like, yeah, it's Microsoft. I'm not surprised. It's it is disappointing though for the Mac users. Bruce B. in Flagstaff emailed a question in. He says, other than OWC Radio, what do you do at OWC? Now, of course, I made the announcement on the last show that I am a full-time Otherworld Computing employee now. I don't want to go into my day-to-day what I do at OWC, but I'll tell you a few things. One of the things that I am spending a lot of time on is events. By events, I mean like the expos. You remember NAB, CES, South by Southwest, those are big events. OWC wants to have a presence there, and we have traditionally. And one of my jobs is to be at those events. So if you're at NAB or CES, for instance, or you're down in Austin at South by Southwest, and you see an OWC booth from this point on, chances are I'll be at that booth. But beyond that, you know, logistics, I'll be working on the logistics of these shows. And I'm also researching new shows in the educational market, in the professional film business, and others that really could benefit our company by being at these events and introducing possibly a whole new customer base to what OWC is all about. The level of care that we give our customers, the award-winning products that we make, the solutions that work. It's not a lot of hype. It's a lot of reality. This is what it is, and these are the real-world numbers, and we're not just going to hit you with a bunch of marketing speak. You can come up and touch the products. You know, those are the kind of shows that we want to start looking at. And as a matter of fact, if you're in an industry that has a presence, like an expo type of an event, that you think OWC should look at, let me know. I'm happy to look at it, and who knows, maybe OWC will show up at your event. It's OWCRadio@MacSales.com. That's the easiest way of getting a hold of me. I'd love to hear your suggestions. And there's a lot of different shows out there. Not all of them make sense for us to be at, but there are some that we're looking at that we've never participated in, and we're having conversations. So it's really exciting, to be honest, and I'm enjoying it a lot. I also work in social media, so make sure you follow us on social media. If you're on Twitter, we're at MacSales. We're on Google Plus. It's such a long address. It's plus.google.com/plus. I know, right? OWC MacSales. And on Facebook, we are facebook.com/OWC MacSales. So those are the places you can find us on social media. I'm posting there. I'm reading what's going on there, and I'm responding. And so is other people, but that is one of the things that I do at OWC Radio. Of course, I am writing for the blog at MacSales, Otherworld Computing, blog.macsales.com. And when I have new content, I'll let you guys know about it. But if you're curious on what I'm writing there, just look for OWC Tim. That's what I'm writing. But there's such great content. If you haven't been to the blog site lately, you're really doing yourself a disservice. There's some great content up there. It's not just new product announcements. It's not just advertising. Go up there and read good content. A lot of it will help you get more out of your Mac, more out of your iPad, more out of your iPhone. Maybe there's some cool apps that we found that we want to share with you. Maybe there's some industry news that we'd love to get your feedback on, your take on. All of that happens on the blog site of MacSales.com, and I'm proud to be a part of that, too. It's so much fun. And, of course, OWC Radio right here. That's what I'm doing at this exact moment. I love to get feedback from you guys. It really does make a huge difference in show prep and what I'm going to be talking about and just getting your opinion on things. Because, honestly, John F., that's only a little bit of the email exchange that we've had talking about Skype. A lot of it was he'd found an error that I did with the XML file, the RSS feed, if you will, for the show. And he said, hey, did you know about such and such? And I went and fixed it. And then he found another mistake, and I went and fixed that too. It was fantastic. I loved it. Thank you very much, John. And we were talking about other things, and it made me start thinking about what are we going to do with OWC Radio? What directions do we want to take it in? Which directions don't we want to take it in? And I want to get, honestly, my desire is to get you guys much more involved in this show. I don't want it just to be half the show me talking at you. I want to be talking with you. And this episode, of course, is another one of our customer spotlight. And I think you guys will like this. And I want to get you on the show as well. And by the way, John, that's an open invitation. Let me know if you're interested in coming on the show. I'd love to have you. Obviously, I think you'd have a lot to contribute. But this is going to be the interview with, let's not call it interview. Let's call it a conversation with Paul Lefevre. I want to make sure I get this right. He's the Zojo Developer Evangelist. That's a mouthful to say. I learned a lot. I think you guys will learn a lot too. The conversation goes in some very interesting places. And he's an interesting dude. I think you guys, and look, if you're a developer, you definitely want to check out this software. I am not a developer, but I went and looked at it. And maybe they just do a really good job with how they present it. But I kind of felt like, oh, you know what? Maybe I could actually develop some software. If I only had an extra 24 hours every day, I don't. But it's very interesting nonetheless. I wish I was a developer, because talking to Paul here kind of got me excited about it again. And honestly, I'd love to be able to kind of nudge my kids into programming as they get older. I think it would be a very lucrative job for them. But I think it's also rewarding. I mean, you're creating something. Maybe you work for yourself, maybe you work for a big company and writing software for them, but you're creating something. There's a physical, I guess not physical, but you know what I mean. There's a thing that you helped make, or you made all on your own. And not a lot of people get that opportunity to do something like that, create. And my hats are off to developers. I've always had a healthy respect for them. Even back on the original OWC Radio, we had developers coming on the show, and to me, they're rock stars, to be honest. They make these computers useful, because without the developers, it's just a box, right? I mean, and they develop everything from how the fonts look on your screen to what the app does and how these things can really change your life. Developers and the software they made changed my life. You know, that started for me in 1995. And if it wasn't for one piece of software that one guy wrote, I wouldn't be here right now. So rock stars to me developers to me are just rock stars. And, you know, some of them are more popular than others. Some of them have a ways to go. But if you're a developer, my hat is off to you, really. I wish I had the skill, and I admire what you guys and girls do. And I'd love to have more developers here on the show. And if you're interested, or even if you're not a developer, in fact, most of you probably aren't, if you're interested in coming on the show and just sitting down and chatting, talking, I'll work around your schedule. If you want to do it on a Sunday afternoon, well, as long as football's not on, because I'm addicted to my football team. We'll sit down, we'll talk on, yep, you guessed it, Skype. And we'll just have a fun conversation. This interview with Paul goes for a little over a half hour. I hope you enjoy it. I'm pretty sure you will, because I had a great time talking to him. And again, if you want to be on the show, owcradio@maxsales.com. So with that, I'm going to wrap up this segment of OWC Radio. We're going to be back next week. Next week's another cool interview. We have a musician, and he's someone that I actually knew before we sat down to do the interview. His name's Kevin Reeves, fantastic musician. And spoiler alert, he gave me permission to actually play one of his songs at the end of the interview next week. So music next week, that's cool. I mean, we have music at the beginning of the show, but this is, you know what I mean. It's cool. But this is the interview with Paul. Check it out, and I will see you guys next week. And back here on OWC Radio 2.0, the last few weeks we've had special guests on the show, customers of OWC, and we are continuing that trend this week. This is going to be a fun one, I think, because this is a developer, and it's someone who really gives back to the development community. His name is Paul Lefevre. He's with Zojo Development. Now, what is Zojo, number one, Paul? What is that? I know a lot of people probably haven't heard about it, but it's quite a popular and robust programming language. How do you describe it? development tools.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks, Tim. Zojo is a development tool, and it's a cross-platform development tool. So it lets you create apps for desktop, Mac, OS X, Windows, Linux, and you can also create web apps with it. And right now we have an alpha testing the ability to create iOS apps for your iPhones or iPads.
That's pretty cool. I'm not familiar as much with the development process myself. I'm not a developer, but I am very familiar with some of the programs that were created using it, especially Lightspeed. I spent 3.5 years basically living inside Lightspeed, so I'm very familiar with the end result. But if I'm of a mind to want to learn how to develop, and I'm not, by the way, but somebody out here there listening might be, what's Zojo do for them? Why should they get into this instead of, say, investing in Apple's tools or Microsoft tools or Google's tools for developing?
Right. Well, we like to say that Zojo lets ordinary people make apps. And it's so much simpler. I mean, Apple's tools are great. They're free, of course. Anyone can grab them. But they're pretty complex for someone that doesn't have a strong programming background to just dive right in. And heck, they're complex for people that even do have a strong programming background.
I've tried, and I couldn't make heads or tails of it, to be honest.
Yeah. One of the things that I like to say is I do Zojo webinars every week to try and help people create their apps and tips and whatnot, is that you can probably start your download for Zojo, get it downloaded, installed it, and run through the quick start and build your first Zojo app before something like Visual Studio or even Xcode finishes downloading, let alone installing. So it's easier to use, it's more approachable, and the ability to create your apps on multiple platforms is pretty powerful thing, particularly people that do consulting. I came into it myself many, many years ago. Unlike you, I'm a relatively new Mac guy. I didn't get my first Mac until like 2001, I believe it was, when OS X came around. Mm-hmm. I've never used a Mac before OS X. And after I got my first Mac, you know, I was drawn to it because of OS X and its Unix roots, having been a programmer for many years. I got it, playing around with it. My daughter was just about to be born, so I was making videos using all the cool iMovie stuff that was new at the time. But you know, I got the urge to program it, and I started looking around for programming tools. And back then, there weren't a whole heck of a lot of them.
No, it was pretty anemic. I remember Code Warriors was big, but they were, you know, in 2001, they weren't real robust for OS X programming.
Right, and they also used C as the programming language, which I wasn't terribly fond of. But I ended up finding a product at the time was called Real Basic, which is now morphed into Zojo.
I didn't know that, because Real Basic was very popular. I remember going to Macworld Expos, and they used to have really big booths there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Zojo is the name of Real Basic as it's moved throughout the years. It's been around since the late 90s, I guess. And so I latched onto it that way, and because at the time I was heaven forbid, but I was a Windows developer using Microsoft's tools. But I gravitated to that. I started writing for the Real Basic magazine at the time. And then over the years, I got pretty fed up of coding using Windows, .NET, and that sort of stuff. It can get pretty complicated pretty quickly. Microsoft has a habit of introducing a technology and then kind of yanking it away from you right after you get good at it, which can be frustrating to
develop. Yeah, a little bit.
And then over time, I ended up starting my own consulting business based off of Zojo. And then a few years ago, I actually started working for Zojo as their developer evangelist, which is what I do now.
How do they approach you to become, you know, the developer evangelist? And what does that entail? Obviously, you said that you do some webinars on a weekly basis, and I've seen some up on YouTube. But what does your job entail, and how did you get it?
Well, my job entails making it easy for people to create their apps using Zojo. So, I mean, how did I get it? Just loving the tool, I guess, and having done so much with it is they were looking for someone to beef up their documentation. And I had done that and many other things. We'd already known each other. You know, I was friends with most of the staff there.
Paul is still hanging around. Someone may as well just put him on the payroll.
Yeah, exactly. Can't get rid of him.
That's right.
So we talked a bit and then ended up deciding that this sort of position would really help you know, promote the product and help people use it more effectively. So, I mean, what I do is I've rewritten the entire user guide. I keep that updated. I am in charge of all the examples that come with it. We now have over 250 examples that are included with the product so that you can kind of have a starting point for the type of thing you're looking to create. I do the weekly webinars. I am very active in our discussion forum to help our user community with questions or direct people towards things, stuff like that. We get a Twitter account. That's, you know, that's what the thing is these days. And, of course, the webinars are a thing we've been doing now for about a year. And we've been doing those weekly. And much like you're doing here this week, Tim, is I've been starting to bring on guest speakers for our webinars to help spread the love around the community.
You know, I think it's important. Obviously, I'm doing that here on OWC Radio. But for you guys, I think it's fantastic. If I'm a developer looking at your tools and I can see other developers talking to you guys and involved in these webinars, I think that would be a pretty good selling point. Can you accurately measure how many people are out there using Zojo now?
Well, it's a tough thing to accurately measure because, I mean, Zojo is licensed with a subscription model that doesn't expire. So you can buy a license to Zojo once and then use it for years and then 3 years later decide to renew because you want one of the new features of the new product that's available then. So we have a number of users that's listed on the front of our Zojo.com homepage. I actually don't have it right in front of me at the moment, but it's fairly substantial. And like I said, it's been around for, what are we talking now, 15 years?
Yeah, that's a long time for, and really an emerging market still. When Real Basic came out, programming, becoming a programmer, wasn't necessarily as big as it is now, I don't think. There was no such thing as apps back then. You know, it was shareware or it was freeware, or you went to work for a company like Adobe or, you know, a big company. But very few people, very few developers could really make a go of it on their own, by themselves, as an independent developer. And that's all changed now. It's a completely different world. How did Zojo kind of work its way from where they were to where they are now, where development, some developers are almost like rock stars at this point? How do you guys navigate that?
Well, development rock stars are the guys that have the podcast that I like listening to.
They're fun. But I've listened to a few myself. Marco, for instance.
Yes, yeah, that's a great podcast. I love listening to Marco talk. Yeah, I mean, the thing about programmers is that, you know, they just love creating things. And Zojo's just kind of followed along the trend with the initial goal, I think, always right in the back of our mind is just, you know, we're multi-platform. We want to make it easy for you to create apps for whatever it is you use. Now, most of us use Macs for our development, most of us at Zojo anyway. And the main reason for that is just because a Mac is the only computer that can run the major operating systems very easily.
I said that the Mac is the only true PC because it's the only one outside the homebrew hacking community. But it's the only computer that can run the Mac, Windows, and Linux, and Unix at the same time, all together.
Exactly. And when we're working with Zojo, that's incredibly important because every day I use primarily VMware Fusion. And in there, if you look at my VM list in VMware Fusion, you'd be shocked because there's probably like 30 VMs that I have in there. I've got just about every version of Windows you could imagine set up in there. One of the benefits of having an MSDN account. And I've got multiple versions of OS X set up in there. And then, of course, Linux. Good God, Linux has infinite number of versions and distributions. And
I don't know how you'd even keep on top of that.
That's pretty challenging. We've got a few we focus on, and I've got those set up. But I'm kind of a nerdy geek, and I like different operating systems, so I'll install new ones when I hear about them and try them out.
How big is your hard drive?
Yeah, exactly. Hard drive, it's not singular.
No, right.
I have a... My main machine is a Mac Pro. I have a 2009 Mac Pro.
Good machine.
Which I love. The thing is a workhorse. And I love the fact that it's got all that internal storage drives. So I have in there, I've got, I guess, 5 drives in there now. I've got some SSDs from OWC, of course, which make all the difference when I'm running the VMs because they obviously hit the drives quite a bit. And then I've got a bunch of other, you know, standard drives just so I can have tons of storage space. I haven't totaled it up lately, but I bet I've got about 6 terabytes in there at the moment, which is primarily virtual machines and maybe home movies of kids.
We all have those on a lot of hard drives. That's I still go back to some of my old iMovie files and think, I need to export this in a way that I can, you know, do something with it still. How does the new Mac Pro, I mean, is that anything that's even on your radar? Because you got all these internal hard drives, and yes, you can slap a Thunderbolt 2 drive to the new one, but then you've got a lot of cables, and it's not as clean.
Yeah, I mean, the new Mac Pro, you know, I've read everything I could about it.
Sure.
It's just, the thing is just gorgeous. It's an interesting design, but I'm really hoping that my Mac Pro lasts me very, very long, and I continue to find out ways that I can, you know, extend its life.
That's what OWC is all about, really. It's enabling people with a slightly older technology, and honestly, really older technology, to keep it going, keep it running, because not all the new stuff is appropriate for every user, and there's got to be a resource out there to help those users with the older equipment keep them going. And obviously, that's one of our mandates at Otherworld Computing, is to help people like you get the most out of your machines.
Right. And I mean, the big thing, any programmer will tell you that you don't always need the super fastest computer on the planet to do your work. You need a giant screen and you need some fast drives, but you don't need, you know, the video cards that come in the new Mac Pro. Those don't provide a lot of benefit. The multiprocessing, that'll help a little bit with your compiles, but not tremendously. So having, you know, a bazillion cores is not the greatest thing in the world. So the new Mac Pro, from a developer standpoint, you know, I would need to get, you know, the devices to plug into it, so I'd have my storage that I need, and I'd probably want one that didn't have as much video card capability, because it wouldn't be needed. So I don't think it's positioned quite right for the development group yet. So I definitely was torn, because I'm like, oh, when my current Mac Pro, you know, eventually needs to be replaced, what do I move to? And there were certainly a lot of articles about this on the internet. You know, a lot of people are saying, well, the new iMacs, you know, the top line iMacs probably are a better value. We'll see what Apple has when the time comes.
Well, hopefully it won't be for a while. But I mean, you've got a 5-year-old machine, and it sounds like it's going strong still.
Yeah, the thing is a tank. I have I beefed it up earlier this year with it's now running with 16 gigs of RAM, and I can go up to, think, 32.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is important when you're running that many operating systems.
Yeah, definitely, because the newer operating systems all want more and more RAM allocated to them.
Yes,
of course. So I've got the RAM beefed up quite a bit, and I'm never running into that at all. I mean, I'm usually running at least 2 VMs along with the main OS X system at the same time without any RAM issues. The hard drive space at this point, I have plenty, and that's always readily available. The only thing I wish to see is, just like everyone else, you know, less expensive SSDs, so I can completely get rid of spinning hard drives and just have SSDs across the board. And that alone, if those prices drop, that would probably make a bigger performance improvement to my daily workflow than a faster computer.
It saved my iMac from obsolescence, to be honest. I was starting to get a lot of spinning beach balls, and there was nothing wrong with the hard drive. It passed all the tests, but I put an SSD in where the optical drive was, and it just made all the difference. So, Paul, I want to go back in time a little bit. How did you get involved in programming? What was it about programming that kind of drew you in? And was that what you went to school for, or did you fall into it backwards?
Oh, well, you're going way back in time.
Yeah.
All right.
The 1940s.
Yeah. Well, not quite that
long. No.
But it was long ago, in the 80s. I remember this very clearly, because I was outside playing baseball at the time. I was young. I don't know, like 12 or something. And my dad had a friend stop over who brought a computer that he brought into the house and hooked up to the TV set. And this was an Atari of some kind. And I remember my dad hollering out in the yard saying, "Hey, Paul, you got to come in and check this out." So I go in, and his friend had this thing hooked up, and it had BASIC in there somehow. And he typed on there, 10 print Paul 20 go to 10.
Yes.
And my name scrolled across the screen, and my eyes just bugged out of my head. And I was like, oh my God, how do I do that? And so that was it. I was hooked on that. And then from that day forward, I begged my dad for us to get a computer.
What was the first one?
The first computer we got was also an Atari
800.
It was a 400, the one with the flat keyboard.
Yep, that was a 400. That was a good computer, though, at the time.
It was a good computer.
A lot of people forget when they think of Atari, they think of, you know, the Atari 2600 or the 5200, the game systems. But there was a time where Atari, owned by Warner Communications then, saw the future, and it wasn't necessarily a standalone game console. They thought, oh, it's going to be a computer. So they jumped in following Apple's and IBM's lead, and they were quite successful for a while.
Yeah, for a while. I ended up keeping Atari computers. I ended up switching to their successor line, which was the Atari ST, kind of a Mac clone of the day in the late 80s. And I used that for many years until effectively they went out of business, unfortunately.
They're still around, but it's not the same Atari.
Yeah, no, not at all. That name has just been sold.
Yep.
Different people own it now. That's mostly game-focused. But I continued programming throughout the years. And even on the Atari ST, I was writing software. I wrote for magazines. I sold shareware. And then when I went to college, I mean, right through high school, I was doing programming. And this being in the 80s, it was relatively new for a lot of the teachers. So anytime I'd go into a programming class, I usually, I probably almost always knew more than any teacher that had been assigned to teach it. So I quickly became, you know, the teacher assistant for the class, and which was great. And then I went off to college, you know, hey, I'm doing computer science, and worked my way through that. And then I ended up where I am today. But the lull was in the 90s when, you know, Atari went out of business. And at the time, there was really no way I was going to use a Mac.
No, there was a time there in the 90s that, for all intents and purposes, everybody thought the Apple was going out of business. And why would you buy a Mac? Because it's a dead-end technology. Microsoft is ruling the roost, as it were.
Yeah, and being a technical developer, I wasn't terribly fond of the Mac operating system at the time. You know, I had friends that had Macs, and it just seemed very unstable and had to be restarted often and that sort of thing. So I actually switched over to one of Microsoft's NT operating systems, the precursor to XP and the ones that they have now. And so I switched from an Atari to Windows NT. I never used any of the other versions of Windows. Windows 95 or those clunkier ones.
Windows NT was very good. I was an IT manager at the time, and it was the one computer I really didn't have to reboot all that often.
Actually, I missed one little funny footnote. Is before I did switch to NT, I tried something called OS2 Warp.
Yeah, from IBM.
From IBM, yeah. I remember the first PC I bought after I got rid of my Atari was... I don't remember what it was, but I specifically picked out its specs so that it could run OS2 Warp, you know, had the right video card and everything. And then I bought OS2 Warp, and it came, you know, like an 180 floppy disks, and installed it. And I used it for probably less than a year before it quickly became something that obviously wasn't going anywhere, and then switched over to NT. And then I used that up until the day a friend of mine that was at university came over and showed me his PowerBook with a beta of something called OS X on it. And I had never heard of OS X because I wasn't really following the Mac community back in that day. And he showed me that, and I was like, holy cow, what is this? And I was pretty impressed, and I started following Mac sites. And the day that Steve Jobs announced that he was including OS X with all Macs was the day I ordered my first Power Mac.
That's pretty cool. So what were some of the first programs? You said shareware when you were in high school. How did you distribute shareware back then, and what were they?
Well, back then, we're certainly going old school in this talk, aren't we?
Yeah, why not? It's fun.
It is fun. I had a 1200 baud modem back then. I think it was a Hayes. They were the modem makers back in the day. And then for those that don't know a modem, you actually hitched up to your telephone, made funny little noises, and communicated not to the internet, which wasn't available then, but to other people's computers.
Or BBS systems, bulletin board systems, that multiple users could dial in. If you ever saw more than, say, five people on a BBS, that was a popular BBS system.
Right. And there were some commercial ones like CompuServe.
Yep.
And there was one called Genie from General Electric, and another one called Delphi. And I was on all three of those and used them. And, you know, for people now that complain of the cost of broadband or something, think back to back then when CompuServe cost something like $12 an hour to access.
Absolutely.
And being the 80s, you know, that's when 12 bucks was some real money.
That was.
So yeah, I wrote, you know, programs like file launchers. A lot of them were freeware, but the first thing I wrote that was shareware was something that helped with the fact that you had to use your telephone line to go online. And this was actually one of my first years when I was in college, and I had roommates who were not terribly fond of me monopolizing the telephone for the computer. So I wrote a little app that would essentially, you'd run it during the day and tell it the tasks you wanted it to do, get your email, post to the forums, download files, and you'd set up this queue of tasks, and then you'd tell it to start in the middle of the night, and you'd leave your computer on, and then it would log on and do all these tasks that normally were manual back then. You had to type commands into your little terminal.
Right.
And it would do all this stuff. It would grab all your email, pull it down into a format so you could read it, get forum posts, reply to forum posts, pull down the files that you wanted to download because, you know, those things took quite a while. And then when you wake up in the morning, you had a bunch of stuff you could review for the day and then deal with it, have it all sent back up the next night. So that was my first real shareware program that actually had some amount of success.
That sounds like it'd be pretty popular.
Yeah, it's a fun little program to write, and I think it helped me get my first job as well.
I would hope so, absolutely. So what do you do now? I mean, obviously you're working for Zojo, but do you still do development?
Oh, yes. I do all kinds of development. I have a couple products that I still sell on my website. I had my own company called Logical View Software for many years, and I still have a couple products I sell on there that are programming-type tools. Obviously, I write a lot of code for Zojo.
Sure.
I do all the examples. I help people with stuff. And back from the days when I was doing consulting, I have a couple clients that I've kept on board that I still help them with stuff. And lately, I've been trying to get my son hooked a little bit on programming. But when we were talking earlier, I mentioned he seems mostly hooked on Minecraft, which in some ways is kind of a form of programming, so I'm not too upset with that.
Yeah, like I said, my 11-year-old daughter, she's way into Minecraft right now. She even has a little plush animal, I don't know what you call them, toys about Minecraft. She has calendars, but most of the time she's on my Xbox 360 playing Minecraft. And I use the term playing Minecraft because they don't really play. They build stuff. I get where you mean when it's kind of a programming language in itself, Minecraft, because you have to do things logically. You can't just put something up in the sky and expect it to stay there. You have to dig to make a foundation, just like coding. And so I think Minecraft, anyways, is kind of a precursor to getting kids and adults. I know there's adults who do it as well, but getting kids into that mindset, that logical mindset that really leads them to something like programming.
Right, and I agree because, you know, back when I was a kid, you know, just being able to see something put on a TV screen, you know, your name or something
your
like
name
that.
Scrolling to infinity.
Was a major wow factor, but sure. Nowadays a kid's going to look at that and, you know, yawn very quickly. So they need something a little bit snazzier to grab them. And it's kind of fun that something like Minecraft, which has the very old school graphics, is able to grab kids in that way these days. And they certainly can do, apparently some of these little blocks they build with, you can actually program to have some sort of logic in them. So you do end up creating very simple programs that result in, you know, something like a door opening if you set blocks in a certain pattern or something like that.
It's pretty cool. Where do you think the future of programming is going? Do you think it's going to be much more drag and drop? Do you think it's going to be accessible to the everyday person? Because as great as Zojo is, I mean, there's still people like me that are just, I can't wrap my head around programming. I need something more basic than basic. I need something just drop dead simple that I can just go click, click, click. Oh, look, it does exactly what I thought it would. I'm sure we're years and years away from that, but where do you think the future of programming is going?
Well, certainly, I mean, programming is getting simpler and complex at the same time, I think, which is kind of weird. But, I mean, the tools
It makes
are...
sense to me, by the way, the way you just... it's getting more simple. The barrier to entry is getting lower, but yet what you can really do is getting much more complex.
Right, yeah, and it's just more things you have to learn. I mean, the one thing that's always a big grabber is, you know, one thing I did last year, I guess it was December, if you've ever been to the site called code.org, they do a lot to help promote programming amongst, you know, kids and just in the educational community and just the general public to try and get it out there. And I don't know that it's going to become the case that everyone is going to create their own apps or anything like that. That seems rather specialized. I mean, everyone doesn't these days, you know, change their own oil. But the ability to understand how to do that, you know, that thinking process is just incredibly important. And learning how to program can really help you, you know, think through other things that it may stump you. You know, I equate it to, you know, learning how to cook is like following a recipe, which is a very simple program. And
putting the ingredients together and mixing it just so. And
thinking through how to do stuff in a logical, consistent, repeatable pattern is something you learn with programming that you may not necessarily end up applying it to a career in programming or creating apps or anything like that, but it's a useful life skill that you can take with you. So that is certainly one aspect of getting people to learn the program. As far as where it's headed, I mean, as far as I can recall, people have always said, oh, programming is just going to become visual. You're just going to drag stuff around on the screen and, you know, boom, you got an app. And that hasn't happened. And I don't know that I see that happening anytime in the short term. It doesn't seem like that gives you enough control to be able to create apps that are specific enough that you'd actually want to use.
And honestly, I mean, if you're just dragging Windows around, stuff like that, Windows on what? A desktop, mobile, Windows, Mac, Linux? I mean, there's just too many variables. I do want to ask you about, as a programmer, what was life like in 2007 and 2008 when you first saw the iPhone, and then when a year later Apple opens it up to third-party developers? Did that change things for you? What did you see change in the development community?
Well, that was a fun thing to witness, because I had actually created apps for things like the old Palm Pilot back in the day.
Which,
very fun thing to program. There was all kinds of little programming tools for that.
It's a great device.
But they didn't have any sort of app store concept.
No.
You just created your app and you had to get it onto there, usually through USB of some sort, with their little cradles. And you built it on your computer and you sent it over to the Palm Pilot and you had a little icon. But the apps that ran on the Palm Pilot still were very desktop-like.
Yep.
You had to use a stylus. They had, you know, funky little menus and scroll bars and tiny little buttons and stuff. So I was used to having apps that were mobile, but they were always scrunched and kind of difficult to use. And then
it was an extension of your desktop, really, is what the Palm was about. And a lot of phone software at the time was, too, the Windows phones and Palm and even BlackBerry to a certain extent.
So when the iPhone first comes out, you know, I mean, the first year it was out, it was like, oh, a phone from Apple doesn't really seem to do much. I wasn't terribly interested. I had not much reason for a cell phone in general, really. And
That's what we all said back then.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny is that remains true. I have really almost no reason to own a cell phone.
Well, you work from home, correct?
I do work from home.
So, yeah, I mean, you're home. What do you need a cell phone for?
But in general, I have tremendous reason to want to own a pocket computer. And to me, the iPhone is simply the world's best pocket computer that happens to be able to make phone calls when I want, but it's the always-on, internet-enabled pocket computer. And that's when Steve Jobs said, you know, he was building, you know, three things, a phone, an iPod, and an internet communication device. And then he said, you know, do you get it? It's not three different things. It's one thing. The phone I could care less about. And to me, the phone is probably the smallest feature of the iPhone, but it's what ended up being the name of it. And I always find that a little funny.
Yeah, because for a lot of people, I think, who initially bought it, it was a phone. That was the main thing that they used it for. But I always describe the iPhone the way you did. It's a small computer. And the current generation of iPhones, and the ones that's coming, are so popular and yet so powerful. And you can do almost anything with these devices at this point. It's kind of amazing. What do you think of the iPad? Was that more exciting? Because in 2010, when the iPad came out, there was already a development community around it. This isn't a phone at all. This is a piece of glass that happens to be a computer.
Yeah, the iPad's an impressive thing. It's sort of the thing, like back in the 90s, I would always recommend that friends and family buy a Mac, even though I myself would never want one. And nowadays, it's almost the same thing with the iPad, where I recommend people get an iPad. But personally, I need a computer because, you know, I'm a developer.
Sure.
And I like having the pocket computer with the iPhone. I do have an iPad, but I don't really use it as much as I use my iPhone or my computer. But my kids, oh my gosh, they use their iPads all the time. And my mother-in-law her iPad completely replaced her iMac. She doesn't use the iMac anymore.
Everything's on the iPad.
Right. And it's just for the average person, an iPad almost seems like the perfect computer or, you know, electronic device that they need. But for those of us, you know, super geeks that still need to get in there or just are familiar with having everything at their fingertips, an iPad is interesting, but probably not quite as cool as a real computer or the pocket computer.
Well, I have to use a real computer. Obviously, I do podcasting. Now, there's ways I could podcast using an iPad or an iPhone, but I don't have the control that I do on the computer, and it's just bringing multiple sounds into it, different... I just couldn't do what I do on the iPad, and I wish I could. It would be a lot cheaper. but the screen's not big enough. It's just too limiting. Something that would take me an hour to do on the computer, and I don't mean actually recording the podcast. I mean everything that comes afterwards, an hour or two's worth of post-production work, would take me 4 or 5 hours on the iPad simply because of the interface just isn't really ideal for that.
Well, earlier in the spring, I did end up replacing. I also have a MacBook Air that complements my Mac Pro. And I had an older one, a 2010 one, that was really getting a little long in the tooth, didn't have enough RAM, and as you know, they're not expandable really in any way. So I ended up getting one of the newer ones, which has, you know, like the all-day battery life, which is great.
Yep.
And when I was evaluating, though, I seriously looked at several Windows laptops that were convertible between, you know, you could kind of flip the screen around or they had a touch screen so you could use them as a tablet.
Yeah, I think those are pretty cool looking.
They're certainly cool looking, and they're impressive spec-wise when you read about them on the articles and whatnot. But when you go in the store and play with them, they're all really, really heavy and kind of bendy.
Yep. Yeah, they don't feel solid.
And
they
of course,
feel clunky.
They all run some version of Windows 8.
Yep.
So as much as I really would love to have a computer that I could kind of touch the screen on, I can see why Apple hasn't built one yet, because I wouldn't want to touch the screen necessarily when I'm using OS X. But when I do have the MacBook Air and I'm like just reading a web page or something, I do often find myself going up to touch the screen to scroll the page. And it doesn't, and that irritates me. Or
I have a 6-year-old. He thinks every screen, he's getting better now, but when he was first born and, you know, his first 3-4 years of life, everything was a touch screen to him because he understood the iPhone and the iPad. So he couldn't figure out why he couldn't just touch the TV screen to make the channel change or to turn it up or down. Same thing with my Macs. He wanted to touch the screens all the time. So I do wonder if that is really the future of computing, is touch screens everywhere. You don't have to use a touch screen, but you can.
Yeah, it certainly seems like there's going to be something that's going to happen there. And you know, Microsoft definitely took the tack of, well, we'll just merge everything together and see what sticks. And Apple's doing the, no, these are separate for the time being kind of thing.
Yeah, that works for me, but I can understand the Microsoft way too.
Yeah, and I really wanted to like that, because that would mean I wouldn't necessarily need to have a separate device, because I do kind of hate having to throw an iPad and a MacBook Air into my bag when I don't... probably don't really need both. But that's me personally. And, you know, I think I may not be the specific market that this is heading towards.
But then again, it's good that you can recognize that as well. A lot of people can't. They only see their needs and expect an entire industry to kind of revolve around that one need rather than looking at, you know, the planet as a whole and realizing that you particularly are such a small demographic of what you need that no one computer company or technology company is going to develop exactly what you need, at least in the hardware space. Software, a little bit different, but in the hardware space, just not going to happen.
Yeah, no, people do need to recognize that. And, you know, the majority of people that do buy these things are probably not developers. It is not really a lot of us.
Not yet. His name is Paul Lefevre. He is the developer evangelist for Zojo. I'm going to put a link to code.org. You talked about that. What was your website again?
Well, our Zojo website is zojo.com, obviously.
Yep.
And that's X-O-J-O.
Yeah. Because it sounds like the Z at the beginning, but there's really no way to say an X sound, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's like Xerox, essentially.
Right.
And my website is logicalview.com.
Logical view.
And then view is V-U-E.com.
View, U-E. Gotcha. You got fancy schmancy with that one, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I did. Well, you know, this was back in the early 2000s, and, you know, domain names even then were getting a little hard to pick. I can't imagine trying to find new ones these days.
It depends on if you have a very specific product that, or service or whatever it happens to be that just isn't named like anything else. But most of the time, every domain I try to come up with has already been taken. Most of them aren't being used. And the company that's kind of sitting on it, they want like $500 for. So
yeah, exactly.
I'll just put the in front of it and call it a day. Paul, I really want to thank you for coming on this episode of OWC Radio. Fascinating to talk to you. I love to get a developer's perspective on things. I've interviewed quite a few over the years. I think you guys are rock stars. You guys are the people that make what we use in technology useful. I mean, without developers, we wouldn't have game systems, computers, iPads, iPhones, and the list goes on and on. So I hope that you know that, you know, you probably don't get the recognition that you deserve, but there are those of us out here who really do appreciate what you guys do, and I wish I could do it. I don't have that skill set, and I really respect those who do. So thank you very much for what you do, and thank you a lot for being here on OWC Radio this week.
Thanks, Tim. I really appreciate that, and it was certainly my pleasure.